Hey there, I'm Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today. What was life like for women in the Roman Empire? How did Christianity challenge cultural norms about the role of women? In today's episode, we'll see what life was like for a range of women, from wealthy single benefactors to married women to athletes, freed women, and slaves. We'll focus our attention on the head coverings passage in 1 Corinthians 11 and see why men were covering their heads and women were uncovering them. Lastly, we'll work through the options for interpreting Paul's instruction for women to remain silent during church services in chapter 14. Here now is episode 595, part 12 of our 1 Corinthians class, Women in 1 Corinthians.
Women participated in much of the city life in the ancient world. They attended the theater. They went to the forum, which is the marketplace. They watched the Isthmian Games. In Greek times, the women were less free. They weren't able to go to the games, for example. But in Roman times, they were. Some even competed in the Isthmian Games. We talked about them last time. We have an inscription at Delphi that mentions three women, Triphosa, Dionysia, and Hedia, all of which won the 200-meter race. And Hedia also won the race for war chariots, so that's pretty cool. Last time we looked at two wealthy benefactresses, or benefactors, that's probably how we would say that today, Junia Theodora and Phoebe of Kenchreae. They probably were widowed and their fathers were deceased, which is why their name is associated with different things as opposed to their husband or their father's name. So in those kinds of scenarios, a woman could actually arrive at a good deal of freedom. But they also had lots of limitations in the first century. Women could not vote. They could not run for public office. They had limited legal rights apart from their husband or father. Wealthier women actually had more restrictions than poorer women or slaves in the sense of being able to go places. A wealthy woman could not just go to the marketplace, for example, unless she was escorted. Wealthier women were also expected, they had a lot of expectations to focus on the household. They had to manage basically an estate with all these different, what we would call employees, but they would call freed persons and slaves, and you know, they have their own children, and then they likely also live with other relatives, and the wife, the woman of the house, is managing all of that. Whereas female slaves and freed women could work outside the home without any shame. Now, Christian wives had some significant advantages that non-Christian wives didn't have. So one of them is that, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7:4, a wife had authority over her husband's body. And a husband had authority over his wife's body. But, you know, everybody already believed that. Everybody already knew that, like, a wife shouldn't have sexual relations with other men. And that the husband had authority to tell her that. That was commonly understood. And if she broke that taboo, she was going to be in big trouble. So that there's nothing interesting about that. That's just standard. But to say that the wife had authority over her husband's body meant that he couldn't use the heterae, the high-class prostitutes. He couldn't stop at the brothel for a quickie. He couldn't use a slave, either his own slave or a friend's slave, to satisfy sexual urges. He had to be completely faithful to his wife in the same way that his wife had to be completely faithful to him. And they had to have this mutual commitment and vulnerability to each other that I think is really beautiful. Now, as far as unmarried women go, for Christians in 1 Corinthians, we saw two categories of these in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. One was women who had never been married, and the other was women whose husbands had died. So we typically will call those virgins and widows. Okay, specifically talking about women here, not men, but obviously that would also be true of men. Paul says, it is good for them to remain unmarried as I am, but if they are not practicing self-control, they should marry. That's chapter 7, verses 8 and 9. This opened up a whole new category of being a respectable, honorable, single person in the ancient world that just wasn't even there. People didn't think about this very much. Suddenly, we start to see this idea of somebody that's single for Christ on purpose for life. And over generations, there come to be two classes of recognized women in the church. They're actually sponsored by the churches, the virgins and the widows. These are both people that have foregone marriage so they can serve Christ and serve the church. The origin point of this is in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, so I figured I'd bring it up. So as far as wives, virgins, and widows, we have that kind of layout. But then there's also two other important texts in 1 Corinthians on women. The first is in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and then the other is just a couple verses at the end of 1 Corinthians 14. And these both have to do with women, and there's actually an immense amount of literature about each of them, which we can't get into all the nitty-gritty, but learning the background information, as we're going to do now, is actually going to solve most of the problems. So hopefully that will happen for you. Let's start in 1 Corinthians 11. So yeah, for the rest of this, 1 Corinthians 11 and 1 Corinthians 14 are where we're going to be. 1 Corinthians 11 verse 2 says, I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions just as I handed them on to you. But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of the woman, and God is the head of Christ. These words that are translated man are the same as the word husband. And these words translated woman, the word wife. Okay? So in Greek, they have one word that does both. It does man and husband as well. And then the other word means wife and woman. Okay? Which is why the ESV translates this verse. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a wife is her husband. And the head of Christ is God. And I think that makes more sense, as we'll see working our way through the chapter. Not every translation does that. It's actually kind of a bold interpretive move, not as literal, which is ironic because the ESV is famous for being very literal. But anyhow, there is a big debate over this word head. And this word head in the Greek is kephale. A lot of times people say kephale. But this is a word that means, it can mean different things. Wayne Grudem makes a very strong argument that it means authority over. To be the head is to have authority over. Gordon Fee says the word head means source or origin. So it's the origin of something else. And then Margaret MacDonald sees this word as the idea of a representative. I think personally the evidence is pretty strong for authority over, based on Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 and 23, where it uses the same language of head, and it's clear that it's talking about a wife submitting to her husband. That's what I find most convincing. I could be wrong about that. We're not going to get sucked into that debate because it goes on for hours and pages and books, okay? Whatever the definition of head is here, it's not going to affect what I'm saying. At least I don't think it will. Let's look at the first point. The first point is men are supposed to not cover their heads. So that's 1 Corinthians 11:4. It says, any man who prays or prophesies with something on his head shames his head. Now, the previous verse, verse 3, said the head of every man is Christ. So we're not just talking about his physical head. We are talking about his physical head. If you have something on his head, right? So that first usage of the word head is your physical head. But this, I think, refers to Christ. So by wearing something on your head, you're shaming Christ. I think that's what he's saying here. Paul's not just talking about the physical head. He is talking about the physical head, but what that means. Now, Plutarch says, and this is borne out by the statues, that it is usual for women to go forth in public with their heads covered and men with their heads uncovered. This is their culture in the Roman Empire. In the Julian Basilica, which is a government building that they found, there were many statues. Two of them are of note. They portray emperors Augustus and Nero, both with their togas pulled up over their heads in a position known as capite velato. In the literature, they refer to this as veiled, but we're talking about hoods here, not semi-transparent netting fabric. Just so you know, they did have transparent clothing, and some of the writers talk about it, but that was typically something that the high-class prostitutes would wear, not like your average person, okay? So when we say veiled, what we mean is wearing a hood of some sort, covering the head with your garment that you're wearing. Bruce Winter says, men were depicted with the toga drawn over their head. The capite velato, while praying or offering up a libation to a god or gods. Not all participants drew the toga over their heads. Only those taking a leading part in a local pagan rite, sacrificing or praying. The social elite undertook this function. David Gill writes the following. He says, the issue which Paul is dealing with here seems to be that members of the social elite within the church, the strong and the well-born, were adopting a form of dress during worship which drew attention to their status in society. Thus, if men were to keep their heads uncovered whilst praying and prophesying, it would help to emphasize the unity of the church. If they continued to wear the toga over their heads, it would indicate that there was continuing inequality in the church. The uncovered head would restate that the head of every man is Christ. So, elites are jostling for power. You have to imagine the scenario. So you have, first of all, we're in a home, not in a bigger church building. We're in a smaller environment. We're probably in a courtyard in the center of a home, because they had courtyards in the centers of their homes called an atrium. You have many different families coming together. Most of them are poor, but there's a few rich families also coming. And the man of that family, if he's the paterfamilias, is going to want to be recognized as such. And maybe this one thinks he has a higher status than that one because he has more money or because he's in some sort of like elevated position in the government than the other person was. You know, this one's an aedile, that one's a quaestor or whatever, you know what I mean? But whatever it is, you have these little differences. They're trying to assert their status. So in the church service, while they're praying and prophesying, they're bringing up the toga over their head to assert themselves as significant, as the ones who are leading the religious service. This is something they're grabbing from the pagan world and they're bringing it to Christianity. And Paul is saying, you're bringing shame on Christ. You're dishonoring him when you do that kind of thing in church. You dishonor your head by refusing to leave behind your desire for status. Think of the teachings of Jesus. The first shall be last. The one who humbles himself will be exalted. The greatest is the one who serves. And then, of course, his illustration of getting on his knees and washing the disciples' feet. That's Jesus. You're mocking Jesus by doing this sort of thing and seeking this sort of glory for yourself. All right, let's go to verse 5. It says in verse 5, but any woman who prays or prophesies with her head unveiled shames her head. It is one and the same thing as having her head shaved. This is the capite aperto, with uncovered head. Once again, verse 3 said, the husband is the head of the wife. So when it says here, any woman who prays or prophesies with her head unveiled shames her head, I think that's talking about the husband. Because I'm using verse 3 to interpret verses 4 and verses 5. Okay, so verse 3 said, the head of the wife is her husband. So it says it shames her head. I'm saying, thinking it shames her husband. Why would it shame her husband if she took her hood down that she would normally wear in public? First of all, head coverings were established when you got married. Then you would wear a certain kind of clothing, indicating to everyone around you that you're married. In our culture, we have the wedding ring. It tells other people, hey, I'm married. I'm not available. Right? So they had a clothing that did that in their world. Cicero, in his second Philippic, says, you put on the toga of manhood and promptly turned it into the badge of a harlot. You started out as a common whore. Your shame had a fixed price and no mean one. But quite soon along came Curio, who took you out of the prostitute's trade, gave you a married lady's robe, as it were, and settled you down in steady wedlock. What we learn from this, and this is the first quote that reveals this to us in time, because he's writing a few decades before Christ, What Cicero is saying here is that prostitutes didn't wear the stole. Prostitutes wore a man's toga. So that was a clear indication. So, and there were different kinds of togas. We're not going to get into the different kinds of togas that, like, the young prepubescent people wore versus the toga virilis, which is the toga of a man. You know, and then you have the prostitute's toga. But she had to wear a different garment than a married woman. And usually in English, we just translate that as the word robe to refer to the married woman's garment. But it also included part of it that would be used as a head covering when she was out in public. Okay, on the married woman's garment, also called a stolum or a stole. Here's another statement about this. Horace, in his satire, writes, "What matter whether your partner is a married lady or a wench with a cloak?" And the word for cloak is togata, it means wearing a toga. "I never insist, do I, on someone descended from a mighty consul and veiled by a lady's robe?" That's the word stola. So we have these two different categories. Then it goes on, "So stop chasing married women or you may be sorry. You may well find the pain and hardship far outweigh any real pleasure. She may be decked in emeralds and snowy pearls, but that doesn't give her a straighter leg or a softer thigh than Cerinthus boasts. And often the girl with the cloak or togata is better still." So this is advice to use prostitutes instead of committing adultery with another man's wife. This doesn't apply to Christians, right? Because Christians aren't doing either one of those. But the point is, they recognize the difference based on the clothing that they wore. Thomas McGinn says in his book, Prostitution, Sexuality, and Law in Ancient Rome, he says, "As part of the established penalty, a woman convicted of adultery was to be publicly humiliated through open identification as a prostitute. This was mainly achieved by stipulating the adulteri damnata should wear the toga. In classical antiquity, you were what you wore." That's a great line. You were what you wore. We live in a leisure culture in the United States of America today. We believe that comfort is king. And so that's our sensibility. In their culture, they had their own sensibility. They had a certain kind of clothing for the men, a certain kind of clothing for the women. They weren't similar. They were very different from each other. Different women had different garments if she was a respectable woman and married, or if she was a prostitute. Anthony Thistleton writes, "The wearing of an appropriate head covering, such as a hood, denoted respect and respectability. Within the semiotic clothing code of first century Roman society, a veil or hood constituted a warning. It signified that the wearer was a respectable woman and that no man dare approach her as one potentially or actually sexually available." So in this sense, the head covering on the woman, this has nothing to do with Christianity. This is just their clothes and their style, indicated that she was not available. Judith Sebasta, in her chapter, in the world of Roman costume, she says, "As the veil symbolized the husband's authority over his wife, the omission of the veil by a married woman was a sign of her withdrawing herself from the marriage." And this is the issue. Now you see it? It's plain as day. Now that you understand a little bit about their clothes. Bruce Winter writes, "The very mention of the word veil by Paul would automatically indicate to the Corinthians that the females under discussion in this passage were married. The widow would no longer wear the marriage veil." So what are we talking about here? We're talking about a woman who's going to pray and prophesy. She's going to participate in the worship service, and she brings down her hood that she would normally be wearing during that special Holy Spirit activity that she's engaging in this public setting. And it's an insult to her husband. She's saying, "I'm not married." She's saying, "I'm sexually available." Right? These are cultural things that we don't have in our world, but that would apply in their world. And Paul is saying to the women, stop that. Stop taking it down. Just leave it up. And he's saying to the men, stop it. Stop putting it up. Just leave it down. Right? That's all he's really saying here. And then we read the interesting verse about shaving or cutting the hair. 1 Corinthians 11:6, "For if a woman will not veil herself, then she should cut off her hair. But if it is shameful for a woman to have her hair cut off or to be shaved, she should wear a veil." Dio Chrysostom talks about a law in his discourse. He says, Cyprus too had its demonassa, a woman gifted in both statesmanship and lawgiving. She gave the people of Cyprus the following three laws. We're just going to read the first one. A woman guilty of adultery shall have her hair cut off and be a harlot. Her daughter became an adulteress, had her hair cut off according to the law, and practiced harlotry. So I think we have to be careful with this. This is a law from Cyprus. Cyprus is an island in the Mediterranean Sea. It's not Corinth. Was this like a well-known thing, or was this an isolated thing that was just happening on this island? Bruce Winter thinks this was a well-known thing, but he doesn't really have any evidence for that. He just kind of assumes it, as far as I can tell. If it was a well-known thing that a woman with short hair or cut hair was somebody that had been found guilty of adultery, then what Paul is saying to them is, all right, you're taking your head covering down, revealing yourself to be an adulteress, so why don't you just cut your hair then? In other words, like, unmask the fact that you really are an adulteress, which, of course, nobody's going to do that. And then his second half of the verse says, well, if it's shameful for a woman to have her hair cut off or to be shaved, she should wear a veil. So he just, like, lands where he starts, which is like, just put the hood up. That might be the case. I'm not fully convinced of that. I don't think there's really enough evidence about it. David Gill writes about this. He says, if women do not have their head covered, then they are seen to shame their head, that is to say, their husband. If women in the church will not wear a veil, then they will be seen as dishonoring their husbands, which might affect their place in society. If the wife insists on being unveiled, then she might as well wear a sign of humiliation by having her hair cut. It could just be as simple as that, just a sign of humiliation. If she does not wish to bring such shame to her husband, herself, and her family, then she should be veiled. All right, so what is Paul after? He wants to stop men from covering their heads. He wants to stop women from uncovering their heads. And he certainly doesn't want women parading around like the new Roman women that were all the rage in certain high society circles, where they actually were uncovered and committing adultery and getting away with it. And everybody knew, and it was big news and gossip, okay? He certainly doesn't want the Christian women imitating that kind of behavior. And then we get to verse 10, where it says, for this reason, a woman ought to have authority over her head because of the angels. Couldn't resist going into this. I even said early on, I said, you know, I'm not gonna talk about this. But then I just was like, well, why not? Why not, like, just try and dive in, at least give you the options for how people think about this? So one option is that head coverings prevent sexually tempting angels to sin. If you look at Genesis 24, when Rebekah is on her way to meet Jacob for the first time, she's with Eleazar, and Jacob comes out, and she's on the camel, and so is Eliezer, and she says to Eliezer, she's like, who's that guy? And he says, it's my master Jacob. And she says, oh. And she gets off and she puts the veil on. So, like, for her, it was important to wear the veil in approaching him as presumably a sign of respect or a sign to prevent anything inappropriate from happening. So that's one data point. The other data point is Genesis 6, where the sons of God go into the daughters of men, and we get the Nephilim and the giants and all this kind of stuff, right? So Dale Martin is really the guy that has most forcefully argued for this position. He says in his book, The Corinthian Body, the bride in a classical Greek wedding unveils herself before the groom. She thus submits to his penetrating gaze. He and his family cross the household boundary by giving her gifts, thus making her a dependent of their household as she leaves that of her family. The usual term for veil is kredemnon. In Homeric texts, kredemnon can refer to the stopper, seal, or cover of a wine jug. Now, this is the part that's going to blow your mind. Since both medical writers and, it seems, popular opinion conceived of the uterus as an upside-down jug, kredemnon could also connote the closed uterus of a virgin. For ancient Greeks, then, the veil not only symbolized but actually affected a protective barrier guarding the woman's head, and by metonymic transfer her genitals. Paul fears that angels will be sexually tempted by the exposed women and may try to have relations with them. Okay. Not the most convincing position, but definitely amusing. I would certainly give it that. But who knows? Let's look at option number two. Option number two is that the angels are actually just human messengers. And in Greek, there's no difference between the word angel and the word messenger. It's actually the same word, angelos. And so what's happening is actually human messengers are visiting the church service, seeing the women with their heads uncovered, and then reporting back, yo, there's women with their heads uncovered at this thing. What is going on? Right? So this is Bruce Winter's position. In his book, Roman Wives, Roman Widows, he says, Augustus had legislated against the political activities of associations. This is important. Associations. As soon as he had secured power, and all the emperors in the Julio-Claudian dynasty, apart from Gaius, who was a nut job, remained highly suspicious of them. Okay? So this is the idea of voluntary assemblies, which is what a church meeting was. If there was any kind of voluntary assembly anywhere in the empire, the local governors were suspicious and they investigated it. We even have a letter from Trajan, which is a much later time, maybe like 50 years, 60 years later, where Pliny the Younger wrote him a letter. Pliny is a governor of Bithynia. He writes a letter to the Roman emperor. He says, yo, we got a fire department. Is that okay? That's like a voluntary association. And the emperor writes back, absolutely not. Get rid of that fire department. Like, that's where you're going to have sedition. That's where they're going to get together, and they're going to try to overthrow the government. Like, no fire departments. Like, just make sure you have, like, all the equipment you need if there's a fire. And then, you know, they don't need to meet together. So, like, that's, you know, how Romans felt about these kinds of things. So, Bruce Winter also says, those with civic status or wealth whose curiosity was aroused about the Christian faith would not go to any meeting without having a client or others first carry back reports of its activities. The treason trials under Tiberius had left an indelible fear on every Roman because guilty by association had had catastrophic consequences. Paul states the wife is under obligation to wear the sign of her marriage as she prays and prophesies because of what its absence signaled to the inquisitive outsiders. She portrayed herself as the promiscuous Roman wife, i.e. an unashamed adulteress, and therefore, because of the messengers, she should cover her head. Option number three is the idea that angels actually attended worship services, and therefore worship services should have proper etiquette and order to them so as not to offend God or the angels. Joseph Fitzmyer, in his Anchor Bible commentary says, because of the good angels, and he puts good in parentheses there, who are considered assisting at gatherings of public worship, as in Psalm 138:1, which says, before angels shall I sing your praise. See also Tobit 12:12, Revelation 8:3, where an angel functions as a mediator of the prayers of holy people. These angels are explained further at times as cosmic guardians of the order of the world, or even as those addressed when God said in Genesis 1:26, let us make a human being, as Philo held, even though he never calls them angels, but rather God's fellow workers. The woman must have authority over her head and cover it, not only because she is in the presence of men, but because she is praying in the presence of God and his angels. So those are the three options. Honestly, I'm not sure which is the best. So I'll leave it to you to figure that out. But as I mentioned before, I think it was my first session, my First Corinthians teacher, James Walters, used to tell his kids when they wouldn't obey, and they said, why, he and his wife, Marla, would tell the kids, because of the angels. So there you have it. Then we also have this business about hair length in verse 14 and 15, which is worth just touching on a little bit. It says, does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is dishonoring to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory. There is an ancient source called Pseudo-Phocylides, who writes between 30 BC and AD 40, And he says, do not let locks grow on his head, giving advice to parents about a boy. Do not let locks grow on his head, braid not his crown, nor make cross knots. Long hair is not fit for men, but for voluptuous women, because many rage for intercourse with a man. So that's some literary evidence that men had short hair and women had long hair. But like, this is not really a complicated or debated issue because we have so many statues from the ancient world. Like, we know what their hair was like for men typically and for women. And men had short hair, women had long hair. That's just the Roman custom. Now, there were exceptions. There were some statues had a little bit longer hair, and those were the statues of the gods. Like the statue of Zeus or Jupiter, he would have like a little bit longer hair. And then statues of conquered barbarians usually had long, curly hair to portray them as feminine. So that's not necessarily like an example of the status quo. But generally, by and large, shorter hair for men, longer hair for women was the custom. Basically, what Paul's saying here is that, hey, based on this custom, isn't it obvious that men have short hair and women have long hair? And for a woman, her hair is her glory. And, you know, then he starts talking about why she should cover her head to contain her glory or to put the authority on her glory or however you want to say that exactly. Before jumping into 1 Corinthians 14, I want to talk about quick application points for 1 Corinthians 11. The first point is no cross-dressing. Now, 5 years ago, if I said that, nobody would bat an eyelash. They'd be like, wow, Pastor Sean, that's like the most useless application point I've ever heard. But suddenly, it's like a big controversy that guys should not wear women's clothes and women should not wear guys' clothes. This is something that has recently changed in our society. In the Bible, there's no distinction between gender and sex. One's biology determines one's gender. Now, I know this is hard for some, and I think we should have compassion on those who experience gender dysphoria, but in the church service, cross-dressing is simply inappropriate. Like, that's what this is all about. What he's saying to the men is to stop covering yourselves, just be regular guys, like based on the cultural norms of that time. He's not saying that all men for all time have to wear a toga. I'm not wearing a toga, right? But he's saying, let men be men and let women be women in how they dress. Now, there's a big range in our culture of what a man can wear and what a woman can wear. There's a big range on both. And guess what? There's lots of overlap where like a guy can wear pants and a woman can wear pants. And like, it's not a big deal. But there are certain things that are like exclusively feminine, like a dress, for example, that a guy should not be wearing if he's in a church service. That's, I think, an application point for 1 Corinthians 11. See what you think. Read it on your own. See if you agree. Some Christians still believe that women should cover their heads when praying or prophesying. There's actually quite a number of denominations that believe this, including the Amish, Hutterites, Brethren, and German Baptist Brethren, Eastern, Coptic, and Oriental Orthodox churches, Independent Fundamentalist Baptists, Plymouth Brethren, some Holiness churches from the Pentecostal and Wesleyan movements, and old school Latin Mass Catholics. They all believe that 1 Corinthians 11 is to be literally obeyed in the 21st century and that women coming to church should have some sort of covering on their head. But most Christians believe that it was cultural. Thomas Schreiner, who is a very conservative Christian, writes the following. Seeing this text as authoritative does not demand, then, that the cultural expression of the relationship between men and women should be practiced today. In many cultures today, whether women are covered or veiled during worship does not communicate anything about the relationship of men and women, though in first century Corinth it sent a powerful message. So at our church, we don't believe that women need to cover their heads to mark themselves as married in order to pray or prophesy. We don't hold that. Ironically, though, many still believe that men need to uncover their heads in worship. But the reason why we believe, or many of us believe, that men should uncover their heads in worship has nothing to do with how pagans offer animal sacrifices to the false gods. It has to do with laziness and respect. Like, why does a guy wear a hat? All the guys with the hats in the room are all nervous now. I wear a hat all the time too. Why do I wear a hat? Because I don't want to do my hair. Because it's easy. And we live in a leisure culture where, you know, it's easy. And we're not in a worship service right now, so don't feel all convicted. But here's my point. My point is that if it shows respect, then it makes sense to do it when you are worshiping God. But that has nothing to do with 1 Corinthians 11. You cannot use 1 Corinthians 11 to tell men to take their hats off or to tell women to put hats on. Because it just doesn't mean what it meant at that time. To our next and final text, 1 Corinthians 14, verses 34 and 35. I'll also throw in 36 at no extra charge. So, verse 34, women should be silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but should be subordinate, as the law also says. If there is something they want to learn, let them ask their husbands at home. For it is shameful for a woman to speak in church. Or did the word of God originate with you? Or are you the only ones it has reached? Now, when it comes to these verses, verse 34 and verse 35, not verse 36, but just verse 34 and verse 35, there are some scholars who believe that these verses should be taken out of our Bibles, that they are not original to 1 Corinthians. And that is because, well, first of all, every Greek manuscript we have has these verses in it, every single one. But there is a codex, we call it D, Codex D. The full name is Claromontanus. Now you see why we call it Codex D, it's shorter. Codex D, which is from the 6th century, has these two verses, verse 34 and verse 35, has them later on, after verse 40. So it's just taking these two verses and moving them later in the chapter. And then there are two 9th century manuscripts that copied D, and they have that same displacement. And there might be a couple more pieces like that. So the theory is that these verses, verse 34 and verse 35, were in the margin, and then scribes worked them in different places. One scribe worked them in where we see him now at verse 34, and then another scribe worked them in at the end of the chapter, and therefore they're originally a marginal note, and we shouldn't even have them in our Bibles. First of all, that wouldn't ruin my day to just not have to deal with these verses, just for the record. Like, I'm not so eager to like cite these verses and explain them, but you know, if it's Bible, then let's just figure it out. What is it talking about? And then let's submit to the authority of Scripture. Here's the thing. Older, more accurate manuscripts, like P46. P46 is the 2nd century. Has these verses the same place that they are in our Bibles. So does Codex Sinaiticus, which is 4th century. Codex Vaticanus. Codex Alexandrinus. Codex Ephraemi Rescriptus, which is 5th century. And most of the Byzantine manuscripts. So we have this verse, overwhelmingly, these verses are where they typically are in most Bibles. And then we have like just a handful where it's in a different place. Like, to me, that's not good enough evidence to overturn it. So most scholars, apart from Gordon Fee, accept verses 34 and 35 as original. Gordon Fee takes a very strong stance against it. Joseph Fitzmyer, another commentator, I quoted him earlier as the author of the Anchor Bible Commentary. His theory, get a load of this, his theory is that Paul wrote these in the margin originally. So like he was dictating the letter and he's like, oh, well, let me add this in. And he put it in the margin. And so that's why they show up in two different places in the manuscript tradition. I don't know how you'd ever prove any of that one way or the other. All I know is that these verses are in literally every single Greek manuscript that we have. So I think we need to deal with them. And really the way to deal with these verses is to ask the question, are they general or specific? He cannot be saying that women at all times, in all church services, have to always be silent. He can't be saying that. Why? Because 1 Corinthians 11, he had just said that women who are praying or prophesying need to cover their heads. So if he's talking about women praying or prophesying in chapter 11, you can't say in 14, no women can speak. Why make the rule? So I don't think it can be universal. So it must be a specific. What is the specific circumstance? And this is our task. I'll give you a few options to consider. Now, the Corinthians knew what was going on, and Paul knew what was going on, and they made the connection. You know, when he said this to them, they're like, yeah, you're right. We need to do that. But we have to reconstruct it because we're separated by all this time and we weren't there originally. So option number one is the scenario based on verse 29. And we're going to come back to 1 Corinthians 14 later. But in verse 29, it says, let two or three prophets speak and let the others weigh what is said. It's the immediate context of this whole section in the 30s. The scenario here, and this is put forward by Bruce Winter and others, is that wives were publicly judging their husbands' prophecies and disagreeing with them in front of everyone and possibly even getting personal. You can imagine the scene. We're having a church service. One of the husbands stands up, he prophesies, and his wife says to him, I don't think so. That's not right. And you know that like cringy feeling you get when you see a married couple fight and you're just like, let me just go over here. Yeah. Like, I think that's possibly what we're trying to avoid here. A second option is that it's side talk, that the women were engaging in side talk during the sermon time, not during the prophecy time. Typically, and it's explainable because typically women were less educated than men, because their domain was more in the home than outside the home. If they had a local dialect they spoke, as opposed to common Greek, they would speak that in the home with their family. And maybe they couldn't understand the accent of the Greek that the church leader was using to read out Paul's epistle to the Corinthians or some other scripture, anything like that. We have this in English too, right? Where somebody speaks in such a way that you don't understand what they're saying. Have you ever listened to somebody like that? You're tempted to check out. Hopefully you're not doing that right this second. But like, there are some people that speak and they use all these big words and you're just like, what? And you're just like, let me just daydream, right? So it's easy to do that. I understand. So some women could have gotten bored and started chatting. Kenneth Bailey talks about this. Kenneth Bailey is a really interesting person. He says, I have preached in village churches in Egypt. I preached in simple, colloquial Arabic. But the women were often illiterate, and the preacher was expected to preach for at least an hour. And we had problems. The women quickly passed the limit of their attention span. The children were seated with them, and chatting inevitably broke out among the women. The chatting would at times become so loud that no one could hear the preacher. These villages had no electricity and no sound amplification. One of the senior elders would stand up and in a desperate voice shout, let the women be silent in the church, and we would proceed. After about 10 minutes, the scene would repeat. What can we imagine in Corinth in the days of Paul? Paul had just affirmed that the Corinthians were getting drunk at the Lord's Supper. We're going to talk about that next time. And that the prophets and tongue speakers were all talking at once. It seems that some of the women gave up and started chatting. Who could blame them? So that's the idea of side talk, that they just kind of checked out and they were chit-chatting on the side. Then option number three is that the women were asking their husbands clarifying questions during the sermon. This is based on verse 35, which says, if there's something they want to learn, let them ask their husbands at home. If that is the solution to the problem, then it makes sense that the problem could be that they were asking their husbands questions during the service, and he's saying, no, ask those questions at home. This indicates that women were asking questions, seeking understanding, not just chit-chatting. Craig Keener writes about this. He says, what is almost certainly in view is that the women are interrupting the scripture exposition with questions. This would have caused an affront to more conservative men or visitors to the church, and it would have also caused a disturbance to the service due to the nature of the questions. Now, if you might ask the question, why would say the husbands should answer their questions? Why would the husbands know the answer? Well, men in their time had better access to education. Men, a lot of times, worked outside of the home. So even if they were from another area and spoke a local dialect of Greek or even another language and only spoke a little bit of Greek, he probably spoke more Greek because of his business dealings or his, you know, whatever job he had. So that's another reason. And so men were just in a place to have more knowledge at that time. It doesn't mean that they're better. Paul doesn't say men are better than women ever. He doesn't. What he's saying is women should ask their husbands for answers to their questions. Now, asking questions was a really important part of ancient learning, going all the way back to Socrates, 3+ centuries before Christ. But when it came to asking questions, the ancients had a lot of rules about it. Okay, so Plutarch actually talks about this. He wrote a whole little essay called On Listening to Lectures. And he says, in all cases then, silence is a safe adornment for the young man. But even if they didn't have young women in the classroom, so it was just young man in this case. But even if the remarks be none too agreeable, puts up with them and waits for the speaker to pause, and when the pause comes, does not at once interpose his objection, but, as Aeschines puts it, allows an interval to lapse, in case the speaker may desire to add something to what he has said, or to alter or unsay anything. But those who instantly interrupt with contradictions, neither hearing nor being heard, but talking while others talk, behave in an unseemly manner. So it reminds me of the same language that we just read in 1 Corinthians. It is quite necessary, this is a second point he makes, it is quite necessary that in formulating questions, the questioner should accommodate himself to those matters in which he is at his best, the lecturer is at his best. Not forcibly to divert one who is more concerned with the ethical side of philosophy by applying him with questions in natural science or mathematics, or to drag the man who poses as an authority on natural science into passing judgment on the hypothetical propositions of logic. Right? So his first rule is don't interrupt. Let the speaker pause for a long time before you ask your question. His second rule is ask a question on the thing they're talking about, not something unrelated. And then his third point is, they are not willing to give themselves any trouble, but they give trouble to the speaker by repeatedly asking questions about the same things. So don't ask the same question over and over. Don't be lazy, do your homework. It's just like a classic teacher, this guy. And then he goes on right here, for holding back the speaker on every possible occasion by their inane and superfluous questions, as in a company of persons traveling together, they impede the regular course of the lecture that has to put up with all the halts and delays. So you could just imagine the scenario. They're having a church service. Somebody's up there explaining the scriptures. They're talking about Jesus. They're talking about the Old Testament. They're talking about some epistle that Paul had written. And here you have all these people asking questions, and it's disturbing the meeting. And so Paul has two solutions. The first solution is let the women remain silent. That just solves the short-term problem. You still have the actual issue of they don't understand what you're talking about, and they're interrupting and they're asking questions. He solves that with his second point, which is let the women, or wives in this case, learn from their husbands. And that would solve the long-term problem. Craig Keener writes, when Paul suggests that husbands should teach their wives at home, his point is not to belittle women's ability to learn. To the contrary, Paul is advocating the most progressive view of his day. Despite the possibility that she is less educated than himself, the husband should recognize his wife's intellectual capability and therefore make himself responsible for her education so they can discuss intellectual issues together. So, Craig Keener is saying, look, this is asking questions, getting answers at home. That's what's going on here. And I think that explanation makes sense. All right, well, that's enough time for this subject today on women in Corinth. I hope this background information was helpful to make sense of it. I don't think we solved all the problems. I didn't even cover every verse, but I just covered the verses that I had good background information on that I think are useful for you. Next time, we'll dive into communion, which is the second half of chapter 11, and see what house church meetings are like. as we continue in our class, 1 Corinthians in Context.
Well, that brings this presentation to an end. What did you think? Come on over to Restitutio.org and find episode 595, Women in 1 Corinthians, and leave your feedback there. Well, we got a new review on Apple Podcasts. Someone using the name For a Great Life wrote a review titled, "Does Reading the Bible Confuse You? This podcast is your answer." And this person wrote, "It would take paragraphs to describe how helpful and informative this podcast is to understanding the Bible. I used to read the Bible and it went in and out, and I did not retain any of it or understand any of it. This podcast takes the time to explain the Bible word for word. And it's funny and enjoyable. And I always remember what I was taught because they make it so clear and fun and use a lot of stories and analogies. Anyone who is stuck reading God's word can become extremely well-versed by doing the sessions presented, and there are hundreds of them. Plus, free classes. No one asks you to join any kind of membership or organization. Where else do you get free anything from a church?" Well, thanks so much for writing that review. Restitutio is a restorationist podcast, which means it's a podcast that's seeking to get back to the sources for Christian belief and practice. This entails understanding the main source of Christianity, which is the Bible itself. And sadly, because we live in a different time and speak a different language, and our culture is so different, it's easy to misunderstand at least some parts of the Bible. I think there's actually a lot of the Bible, a very high percentage, that is plainly understandable no matter what culture you live in. But this podcast is really dedicated to understanding the Bible in context, and that's really this whole class on 1 Corinthians, is building that background context for this book so that you understand it the way the original recipients would have. But that's not all Restitutio is about. It's also about living out your faith authentically today. What good is it if we understand what the Bible says but don't live it? This is why it's important to put what you believe into practice in your life as well. And we do have a number of episodes that focus on practical Christian living issues. Now, at the end, I also want to mention a couple of events coming up in case you'd like to get together with others. To the British listeners or European listeners, I did want to mention that we have an event coming up in Uxbridge, England, which is just a little bit outside of London, that we have an exciting event coming up called the Unitarian Christian Alliance UK International Conference. So I hope if you're in traveling distance of London that you will be able to come. That's July 24th to the 27th. I'm planning to be there, and I'm hard at work on my presentation for that event. Doing the research and working on a passage that many have been confused by. I can't really say more than that at this time. But if you are in the area, don't miss out. This is the second year they've had this event, and this will be my first time going. And even if you live in the United States like I do, you may want to just get a plane flight and come over and make a whole vacation out of it, or as they would say in Europe, a holiday out of the weekend. If you'd like more information about that, you can go to UnitarianChristianAlliance.org and find the registration information there. They also have a call for papers, so if you are interested in presenting at this Unitarian Christian Alliance, you can write up a paper, and they have all the specifications available on the UCA website, UnitarianChristianAlliance.org. And if your paper is selected, then you will get to present at this event. Also, we have a major summer event coming up in Ohio, the Cleveland area, called Converge. This event last occurred in 2019, and it was a blast. We had, I think, about 300 people come, and we had powerful music and preaching and afternoon activities, and a whole bunch of different ministries and groups attended. And they had tables where people could learn about these different ministries in the United States. And it was a time also for the family with a full children's program, at least during the meetings. So if you are interested in Converge, you can sign up at convergefest.com, and they'll send you an email when registration opens up. It'll be a great time, so I hope to see you there. As it turns out, I'm going to be attending both of these events with my entire family, which is always a treat. Most conferences I have attended over the years, even ones that I have spoken at, it's usually just me. And I have been cajoling my wife to attend events with me. And this year, for whatever reason, my whole family is coming. So I have four sons, and three of them are teenagers. And I'm sure I don't need to explain to you the challenges involved in getting everybody on board with an idea. But I'm very delighted to say that they are all coming to both the UK conference in July and Converge in August. So I hope to see you there. Well, that's going to be it for this week. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, then please share it with your friends on social media or email or by word of mouth. And if you'd like to support this ministry, you can do that at restitutio.org. Thanks so much to all of you who are. I'll catch you next week. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.